We're just coming out of an evening where we've lost an hour. And so within the next 13 minutes, there should be a whole new crowd of people coming in. So we won't judge them. We won't. We'll just scooch over and we'll just, you know, God bless you. Welcome this morning. We won't judge them because we've been learning about character and integrity. And so if you're here with us in the first week, you might remember that we learned that we need to treat others with excellence. So when they show up in about 12 minutes, 13 minutes, we're going to treat them with excellence. But if you were here on the second week, then you remembered that we learned that there's no such thing as no big deal. So technically, but then again, in week three, we learned that we can't consider seasonal sin and it would be a sin to judge them. So we'll be nice to them. But then last week, the fourth week, we learned that we need to refuse to compromise. Coming late to church, that's, I don't know. I'll leave it with you. I'll trust you. In about 12 minutes, we'll see what happens. Well, there's a lot of things that make us unique. There's a lot of things that make you and I and you and the person beside you different from one another. There's unique things that make you who you are that nobody else has, but there's also things that we all share in common. And one of those things that we all, absolutely everybody in this room, shares in common is that all of us care what other people think about us. We all care about what other people think about us. Has anybody ever had this conversation on a Sunday morning? Honey, what did I wear last week? Do you remember what I wore last week to service? Why would you ask that question? Because you don't want to be seen coming to our service with the same outfit a few weeks in a row. People will start thinking that, you know, you don't own any other clothes. Maybe, and that happens at work. You know, Sally wore that green top 3 times this week. Does she not know where the shopping mall is? Does he not know where to buy a new tie? He wears the same yellow tie every Monday. So we think about our wardrobe, but it goes beyond clothing. Have you ever been at the end of a work day, at the end of a meeting, and you relive a conversation that you had with somebody earlier in the day? You actually reenact it in your mind. You think about what they said, what you said, how you responded, how their eyebrows moved when you said something. You dissect it, you analyze it like you're a scientist, trying to figure out, did I offend them? Did I make a good impression? Did I explain myself good enough? Why do we do that? Because we care. We care what other people think about us. And it's not, and I'm not saying that to come down on us, that's a reality of being a human. That's just a part of who we are. We care about what other people think about us. We want people to like us. We want people to understand us. We want people to think that we're funny or good looking. And so that's why we made that comment or made that joke or wore that shirt or that tie or that necklace, is because we want people to think nice things about us. Am I talking to the right crowd? We care about what other people think about us. Now, the problem occurs when we allow that truth to dictate our lives. There's nothing wrong with caring about what other people think about us. I mean, that's just a part of being human. But when that reality begins to determine how you talk, the kind of jokes you make, how you dress because you really want to make an impression on so-and-so, when it begins to control your life, that becomes a problem. It becomes a problem when you start being consumed with these thoughts. So this morning, we want to find a balance. We want to discover how God wants us to answer this question. Who cares? That's the title of my message this morning. Who cares? Because what really matters is what God cares about us, about you. So if you have your Bibles, open with me to the book of Daniel. And we were in Daniel last week, looking at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so if you could open up to Daniel, and just to give you some context for Daniel, the events in the book, they took place about 500 to 600 years before Jesus' birth. Not 5,000 to 6,000 years, like I said last week. Did anybody catch that? I'm re-listening to my sermon, and I'm going, well, that's not true. 500 to 600 years before Jesus was born. Yeah, so that's when all this is taking place. And so what happened is that the Jewish people at this time were taken captive by Gentiles, and they were brought into Babylon. So we've got Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and others, but these are the characters that we hear of the most, who are in Babylon under the influence of the Gentiles. And the Gentiles do everything that they can to denationalize them as Jewish people. They work really hard at getting all of their culture out of them. And so there's a few things that they do. The king, King Nebuchadnezzar, he sets them in a 3-year training course. And he puts them, he has them study Gentile literature. He has them study the Gentile language. And he gives them Gentile names. So Daniel's renamed to Belshazzar, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's actually their Gentile names. Their Jewish names are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they go so far as to change their names. They're working really hard at influencing these people to start living a different kind of life. But there's one other thing that they do, and you'll see it in Daniel chapter 1, verse 5, if you have your Bibles there. And if not, it'll be up on the screen for you sinners who don't bring your Bibles to church. Daniel chapter 1, verse 5. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. So they're given a new diet. They're given very strict regimens in terms of what they're going to eat. And they get to eat the king's food, which I'm sure would be absolutely delicious. Get to drink the king's wine, which I'm sure would be the best of the best. But the Jewish people had a bit of a problem with this. And so if you read in verse 8, it says this: "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank." Now, why would this food defile Daniel as a Jewish individual? Why would it defile him? If you read through Daniel, the book of Daniel, it doesn't specifically say. All that it says is that he refused to be defiled, and so he would not eat this food. But what we do know, based on historical documentation, is that Gentile people all around the world, see, it's not like today where, you know, we bless our food before we eat our food, but most other people who don't believe in God, they don't. Back in this time, everybody had a blessing before their food. It's just that they prayed to different gods. And so these Gentiles would most likely have done a similar thing, except they'd be blessing the food in the name of their other gods, in the name of their idols. It would have been sacrificed to their gods. And so Daniel doesn't want to eat food who's been offered to somebody other than his God. And so he absolutely refuses to eat the king's meat and the king's wine. If you read various translations, the New Living Translation says that Daniel was determined not to defile himself. New American Standard said, "But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself." King James says that he purposed in his heart. Another way to translate it is that he was established in his heart. This was not something that Daniel was going to compromise on. He was absolutely firm. "I'm not going to eat the king's food. I know who it's been blessed by or offered to, and I'm not going to partake of that." And so, let's see what happens in the middle of verse 8. We read this: "Therefore he," who is Daniel, "asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself." Verse 9: "And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel," listen to his statement, "I fear my lord, the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were worse in condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would then endanger my head with the king." Now, chief of the eunuchs here, who is he concerned about right now? His boss. "What does my boss think about me? I fear my lord, the king." And we could relate in a work situation where you care about what your boss thinks about you. Why? Because he probably signed your paychecks, and he could have the power to make them bigger or smaller, or disappear entirely. So you care about what your boss thinks about you now, and we live in a time where you're not at a threat of having your boss behead you. That's kind of frowned upon by the Canadian government. And so we don't even have that level of pressure on us, and yet we still can sometimes say, well, I fear my boss. This is what the chief of the eunuchs is. He is concerned about what his boss thinks about him. I fear my lord, the king. But you know, Daniel didn't. Daniel really didn't care what other people thought about him. He cared what his lord, the king of the universe, thought of him. Notice the difference here. The chief of the eunuchs is saying, I fear my lord. Daniel fears the Lord, capital L, capital O, capital O, R, capital D. It's okay, I can spell Lord. I'm good. Big difference here. Who do you fear? Your boss or the king of the universe? Well, let's continue. Verse 11. Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had sent over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearance and the appearance of our youths, so the others, who deal with your servants according to what you see. So Daniel's saying, put us to the test. See, this is the beautiful thing about faith. Daniel believed that if he did what was right in the sight of God, that he would actually get good results. He had such confidence to say, test us, because I know that this is going to work. But see, people who don't have faith, chief of the eunuchs, they need to see something. You ever had somebody say, I'll believe it when I see it? So Daniel's saying, okay, this is how this works. I'm going to activate my faith now, and in 10 days, you're going to be able to see what I already know to be true in the Spirit. He's giving them what they want. People want evidence. People want proof. People don't want theology. And so he's saying, I'm going to use my faith, and you're going to see some results. I love the faith that Daniel has here. So Daniel says, all right, let's have a test. Verse 14, so he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, surprise, 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 it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all of the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away the food and the wine they were to drink and gave them all vegetables. And all of God's people began to cry because we would rather eat the king's food than vegetables. Maybe that's just me. Alrighty. It worked out for Daniel because Daniel decided to put God first. And what does God do when you put him first? He puts you first. When you put God first, he puts you first. And this is the end of portion of chapter 1 in verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them, listen to this, learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Verse 18, and at the end of the time when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, so 3 years has passed, they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. Verse 20, and in every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired, he found them 10 times better than all of the magicians and the enchanters that were in all of his kingdom. Now we can give the vegetables some of the credit. Some in the natural, right? Kids, eat your broccoli. But vegetables don't make you 10 times better than everybody else in everything that there is to know in life. Agreed? We need a little bit more than broccoli in order to have wisdom that is 10 times better than the rest of the world. This is God. This is God here. They honored God by doing the right thing, and God made them 10 times smarter than the best of the best in the Gentile kingdom. I wish I believed this. Really believed this in my heart when I was in school. I really do. Because putting God first, doing the right thing, thinking if I really believe that God would then put me first and make me wise and give me understanding, I probably wouldn't have cheated on so many tests. Anybody remember those cut-off pants in the 90s where you got to like zip right off here so that you could just have shorts? Everybody remember those? I thought those were invented for tests so that you could write your answers right here, and nobody, because you're right under the desk, right? I know, now you guys are taking notes, like, this is a fantastic idea. And then you just unzip here, and well, you got all the answers right there, and you zip it back up. I don't know if I've ever told you that, Mom, Dad, no. Money well spent at the private school, I tell you. I wish I really believed that if I did the right thing and didn't cheat, that I would have been better off than if I cheated. I really do. I know what you're thinking. Where would he be but by the grace of God? See, you can strive with every ounce of effort that you have. You can work so hard to impress your boss, to impress the person that you're interviewing. You can work and work and work and work and work, and it will not get you as high as if you honored God and put him first. It really won't add up to as much as God can just, it literally said somewhere in chapter 1, we just read that he poured his favor and compassion upon to Daniel. God's favor is far better than your best efforts. So hard work isn't enough, church. We need to honor God. We need to put him first. And that's exactly what we see these Hebrew boys doing. We're going to turn to chapter 6 now of Daniel. It was just a little bit of an appetizer for you. Daniel chapter 6. Many years have passed between Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 1, Daniel is a youth. He's described as a youth. And scholars say by the time that we're in chapter 6, he's about 90 years old. So lots of time has passed here. We had Nebuchadnezzar who was reigning. Then we had Belshazzar reigning as king over Babylon. And now we have Darius who's ruling in Daniel chapter 6. So many years have gone by. And we'll read the first few verses of Daniel chapter 6. And it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom. And over them, three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps would give account so that the king might suffer no harm. So there's 120 put in charge, and there's three over top of that who these 120 have to report to. And of those three, one of them is Daniel. Verse 3, then Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials. So he's number one out of these three highest. Because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But, listen to this, they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful. He had no error and no fault to be found in him. So when these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Can you imagine having such character and integrity that upon hiring a private investigator, nobody could find skeletons in your closet? Can you imagine that being who you are? They're looking and searching. They can't find any dirt on this guy. So they say, well, the only way that we're going to be able to get him is if it's in something that he is obeying his religion by, him obeying and serving his God. It's the only way that we're going to be able to do this. Now, these other two Gentile rulers, they were serving right alongside Daniel. But it said the king favored Daniel. The king favored Daniel over these other two high officials. So why do you think that this is happening? What's the motive here? Why are these other high officials and satraps coming against Daniel? Because they're jealous. Why? Because they care about what the king thinks about them. Remember, this is all of us here. We all care about what other people think about us, and that is why this is happening, because everyone else is going, well, hey, I don't like that he has preference in the kingdom. And so that's why they do this. Verse 6. Then these high officials and the satraps came by agreement to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. Now, we really need to note how it is that this meeting happened. In verse 6, it says that they came by agreement. I don't know what version you're reading. I have a cross-reference that said they came thronging. They came in a throng, a mob. The Amplified version says that they came thronging. They came tumultuously. 120 satraps, two high officials over them. Can you imagine 122 people rushing into your office? Can you imagine having an office big enough that 122 people could rush into it? That is how they approached the king. 122 people charging into the king's palace. Do you think the king would have been a little bit anxious about what was going on? The only time throughout history that people would approach the king in this manner was if they were getting severely attacked and they needed to get the archers out, get all of the army ready for battle, or if they were being overtaken and they needed to go and hide. It was the only time that you would take all of the leaders to approach the king. And so they thought this through, because can you imagine what the king's thinking when everybody comes in? They think that I'm expecting some tragic news. We're about to go to war. We're being overtaken. And then they simply say, yeah, we just kind of had this idea about this new law that you should pass. Would you like to sign it? As the king, you'd be relieved. Oh, good. Nobody's killing us. Nobody's attacking us. No bad news. All you need is my signature. These guys thought this through. Approach the king. Get him to sign the document. We don't know why King Darius signed it. We don't know if it was just to get them to leave the office. We don't know if he really understood the full implications of this law. But when he signed it, there is no undoing it. It said they made an agreement in the same way that the Medes and the Persians did, which means when the deal is done, it's done. There's no going back. Even the king doesn't have the authority to overrule it. And so this is a done deal. For the next 30 days, if anybody asks anybody for anything except for the king, they're going to get thrown into a den of lions. Sometimes I wonder if we'd be a little bit more productive in our workplaces if we had a den of lions in the backyard. If your report's late, Birdie hasn't eaten in days. That's a joke. I'm not seriously suggesting that we start putting in dens of lions. Okay, there we go. Now, what does this have to do with Daniel? They knew Daniel. These high officials had been around Daniel enough to know what kind of a person he was. Daniel was a man of prayer. And they knew that. They knew that Daniel was going to be praying to God. They didn't think that by making this law that it was going to deter Daniel from doing anything. That wasn't the point. The point was to catch him doing that very thing so that they could get rid of him and competition would be gone. But Daniel was a man of faith. He was so consistent in his prayers. As we read, let's read in verse 10. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, I love that that's the beginning. That's the first thing we hear. Daniel knew. Daniel was fully aware. He knew that the document had been signed. He knew about the new law. What did he do? He went to his house, where he had windows in the upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. What's Daniel doing? Daniel's just being Daniel. If I used to pray three times a day in front of this open window that looked towards Jerusalem, why would I change that now? Daniel's just continuing his lifestyle. He's not showing off. He's not opening the window to brag about his prayer life. This is something that he's done before. But I mean, if you've read through this story, I hope you've thought like I have. Daniel, why didn't you just shut the window? Why didn't you get somebody to sew you some curtains? Nobody would have known you could pray to God. Because we have this awareness that God hears us wherever we are. We have that. We know. It doesn't matter where you are, windows open, doors open. Doesn't matter where you are. God hears you when you pray. So why did Daniel pray with an open window towards Jerusalem? Psalm 5:7 says this, "But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down towards your holy temple in fear of you." Psalm 28:2 says this, "Hear the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cry to you for help. I will lift up my hands towards your most holy sanctuary." This was a part of their prayer life as Jewish people. It was towards the temple in Jerusalem. And so can you imagine, just put yourself in Daniel's shoes. He's been taken away from the temple. He has been removed from what he knows to be the very presence of God. Wouldn't you open your window? If you thought that's where God is, that's where you knew God to be, wouldn't you open your window when you prayed towards your God? And so this is all Daniel's doing. He's following his own heart, his desire for God. He's going to open that window and keep on praying just as he did before. So this is Daniel's prayer life. 3 days a week on his knees, even on holidays and long weekends. This is just who Daniel was. And Daniel didn't allow what other people may think of him to change who he is, what he does, and how he spends his time. I want you to ask yourself, are you the same person that you are at home as you are at work? Just ask yourself, are you the same person? Daniel didn't change. Even at the point of his life being threatened, how often do we change when we're in different environments and different circles? One of the things that I just fell in love with about my wife, Christine, is that she doesn't change. She is who she is. She wasn't church Christine on Sundays and during the week when we were at youth group and play practice. She was who she was. I like that about her. But how often do we change? Based on our environment, based on who's around, where we morph because we are concerned about what other people think about us. But Daniel doesn't change. He's a man of prayer. Well, let's catch up in verse 16. The king commanded. Okay, so they approach the king before we read verse 16. This is what happens. They see Daniel praying. They approach the king and they say, "Hey, you know this law that you've just signed? Well, we hate to tell you this, but we found somebody who is actually breaking the law." So they bring Daniel before the king, and the king is just heartbroken. He works day and night trying to undo this, but he can't because it's a law. He can't change it. He can't. And so he's forced to live up to this law. So verse 16, "The king commanded that Daniel be brought down and cast into the lion's den. And the king declared to Daniel, 'May your God, whom you serve, continually deliver you.' And a stone was brought and laid at the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of the lords, that nothing may be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him." Verse 19. "Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And as he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a loud tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, 'O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?' Daniel said to the king, 'O king, live forever. My God sent his angels and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him. And also before you, O king, I have done no wrong.'" And the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Now, some people have claimed that clearly the lions must not have been hungry that day. Well, the king proves that to be not the case because he finds those who accused Daniel and made this whole thing happen, and he threw them into the lion's den. Oh, along with all of their wives and children, by the way. Wow. Throws their families into the den of lions. And verse 24 says, the lions overpowered them and broke all of their bones in pieces before they reached the bottom of the den. That is a hungry lion, my friends. Before they hit the ground, every bone was broken. Hungry lions. And Daniel said, an angel actually came and shut the lion's mouth. Why? Daniel said, because I was found blameless. Not perfect. Not perfect. See, sometimes we get the idea because we don't have any negative stories about someone that they were actually perfect. Nobody's been perfect ever except for Jesus. Nobody. So he was found blameless. Why? Because he continually honored God, put him first, continued to pray. Why? Because he wasn't too concerned about what other people thought about him. Because he realized what's more important is, what does God think about me? You know, if God doesn't shape our integrity, other people will. If God isn't the one who shapes your integrity, other people will. They'll shape your standards. Your friends, your family, who do you spend time with, who speaks into your life? If God isn't shaping you, they are. And Daniel, in the midst of being surrounded by non-God-worshipping, idol-sacrificing people, continued to do the right thing. Even though when he was surrounded by terrible influence, people all around him pressuring him to conform to society, conform to culture, Daniel never did. Because it was God who shaped his integrity as a person. See, when faced with a decision, you need to ask yourself, is this something God cares about? Because if God cares about it, I care about it. It's okay to be concerned with some things about what other people think. This is us relating to one another. But you got to ask yourself, God, is this something that you care about? Because if you care about it, I want your opinion, not theirs. God, if you want me to wear the same outfit 2 weeks in a row to church, silly example, but I hope you get my point. When there's an opinion on the table, God's is more important. What does God think about your situation? Character and integrity, as seen in the life of Daniel, means caring more about what God thinks about you than what others think about you. You've just got to decide, I care way more about what God thinks about me than what anybody else thinks about me. Even my spouse. I mean, it's got to be that deep that you literally are much more concerned with what God thinks about you and your life and your decisions and your future than anybody else. Anybody else. We must be consumed with God. What do you want? There's a whole lot more. We care a whole lot more about what other people think about us than we should. Let me give you an example. You really feel like you're supposed to be a part of something a few weekends down the road. I mean, fill in your own example. It could be your kid's baseball tournament. It could be a church event. It could be whatever it is you got on the calendar. You want to be a part of that. And then you get a phone call from your brother, your sister, your cousin, and you find out that that Saturday is the annual family barbecue. And you think, well, I mean, I've got to go to that. I've got to cancel whatever else. I feel like this is what I'm supposed to do. I feel like I need to be here for my kids. I feel like I need to be here for my church. Whatever example you want, fill it in. I feel like this is where I'm supposed to be. But what's mom going to think about me if I don't go? what's Cousin George going to think about me if I don't show up? Last year they came when we hosted the annual family barbecue, and what are they going to think about me if I don't go? Maybe you don't like my example because it's a little bit too close to home. We care. But what are they going to think? What's mom going to think? What's dad going to think? What's Uncle Bob going to think? Why do you care so much what other people think about you? Well, because they're family. And Pastor Tim, it's the annual family barbecue. I don't think you're getting this. It only happens once a year. It's a big deal. You care too much about what other people think about you. You know, church, we've got to stop living our lives based on other people's expectations. Well, I've got to be a part of that because I'm expected to. Well, who expects you to? Well, I really feel like my friends, you know, they expect me to be there because, you know, I said that I'd be a part of something, and so there's this expectation. Okay, well, who expects you to be there? Well, they do. And I don't want to lose my relationship with them. So I got to do what they tell me to do. Listen, you'll spend the rest of your lives just doing what other people want you to do if you live by other people's expectations. You'll never do what you want to do. You'll never make a decision that you want, let alone the important decisions that God really cares about. Because you will continually say no to God, no to God, no to God, without even trying to, because you're so busy trying to make other people happy and fulfilling their expectations. God, I don't have time. God, when am I going to have time to be a part of that? You've called me to do something. You've called me to start a business. God, you've called me to be a part of serving the church. God, you've called me to be a part of something in my community. God, how can I do that when I've got family coming over Friday night, and Saturday I got to be a part of this wedding, and Sunday, oh goodness, don't get me started on Sunday. Why? Because they expect me to be here, and this person expects me to be there. And because at the end of the day, we care way too much about other people and what they think about us. When we need to be so consumed with God, what do you want me to do? God, what do you think about me? Where do you want me to spend my time? How do you want me to invest my money? How do you want me to be able to live my life? Because guess what? No offense to any of you in the room, God's opinion means way more to me than any of you. And it should be the same for you to me. Don't even let the pastor have expectations on you if they come above God's. No. God's opinion is what matters. There was a time in the book of Acts. I'll ask the worship team to come on up as I'm closing. In the book of Acts, we read about the disciples experiencing continued opposition. Everywhere they'd go, they'd be telling people about Jesus. They'd be laying hands on people and healing them in the name of Jesus. And people didn't like that too much. So the authorities would come and they'd take them and put them into prison, and then after they did a little research, they found out that they didn't really break any laws, so they'd have to let them go. And this is what they would say: just stop using the name of Jesus. That's all they wanted. They said, you can go around, you can talk to people all you want, you can pray with people, just stop using Jesus' name. And this is their response. Peter and the apostles in Acts chapter 5 says this: we must obey God rather than man. Who's more important? We must obey God rather than man. So, you know, we know that we should be caring about what God thinks about us. But do you know what holds us back? What holds us back? God's more forgiving than your family. So if I make Aunt Susie happy, then that's easier for me because God will forgive me, but Aunt Susie won't. That's what holds us back. God's goodness cannot be an excuse for our sin. We can't rely on that and say, well, God, I'm going to put you second just because you're so good to me. That's backwards thinking. Yeah, God will forgive you. He will. God will never stop smiling in the midst of you denying him, rejecting him, passing by opportunities. He won't stop smiling because he loves you just so much. But it's not an excuse. I love this quote from John Wooden, a famous basketball coach. He said this, "Be more concerned with your character than your reputation, because your character is who you really are. And your reputation is merely what others think that you are." Well, Pastor Tim, I just really care what people think about me because it's my reputation. I want to have a good reputation. Listen, your reputation is not important. It's not. But your character is. That's who you really are. That's who you really are. It's your character on the inside. And that's what matters. And we've got to get to a point where, as a people, we are more motivated by our character than by our reputation. And it's a whole lot easier said than done, because this affects all of us. All of us. We care about our reputation. But could you imagine what would happen if we made this our reality? Can you imagine how this would change us as a people if we literally started caring more about what God thought about us than what other people thought about us? Because I sincerely believe that I am only scratching the surface of how this would change our lives. You know that nobody would ever lie again if this was our reality? Because why do people lie? To save their reputation. I don't want you to think bad things about me, so I lie to you. If we would truly live this out, this would change our conversations. But you know what we need to do, and I really believe that this is step number one for us. We've got to make up our minds that we are not going to get offended. We're not going to get offended. When you give your advice, when you share your opinion, and somebody doesn't follow through, somebody decides to do the opposite, and you go, "Well, why did they even ask me in the first place?" We've got to decide, you know what? I'm not going to get offended. I'm not going to get offended, no matter what. You could do something that just seems so evil in my eyes, and I am just not, watch this, I'm not even going to care. I don't care. I don't care. Well, that's real harsh, Pastor Tim. Yeah, it is. But it's not because I don't love you. It's just because I don't care. I care much more about what God thinks about me. Well, but Pastor Tim, I thought you cared about my opinion. Yeah, your opinion's okay. It's all right. It's not nearly as important as his. What does God think about you? What does God want you to do in your life? Because Daniel said, it doesn't matter what other people think about me. I'm going to worship my God. I don't care what the... Do you think Daniel would have cared what the person beside him was thinking in a prayer service? It wouldn't have even entered his mind. Well, I just don't know. I just don't feel like I can really worship the way I want to because people will laugh at me. Who cares? Get over yourself. Who cares? God, what do you think about me? If you want to dance, if you want to shout, worship him. Who cares? Who cares what I think about you? Don't you ever care what I think about you? What does God think about you? I sincerely believe that this is scratching the surface, that this would change our lives entirely if we were motivated more by God's thoughts than others. I think it would change everything. I think it would change the face of our culture if we stopped caring what other people thought about us. And this is not an excuse to be rude to people. This is not an excuse to ignore people. And someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, good morning, so good to see you." Whatever. I don't care about you. Pastor says I only have to care about God. This isn't an excuse to be rude. It's understanding priorities. Who's first? I choose God. I choose God. Let's stand together. And let's just spend some time loving on Jesus. Spend some time praising him. And I really want to encourage you to allow your mind to be just consumed on God and God alone. Nobody beside you, nobody around you. Just Jesus. Let's worship.